And then it was the hottest, most punishing part of the summer, the dog days, and all of Napoli went quite mad, as usual. The more excitable signorine were not content merely to weep loudly at the Teatro San Carlo, but often fainted dead away when popular tenors sang the more melancholy arias. New miracles were reported every second day, most of them so lunatic that the church quickly disavowed them. One peasant claimed the Holy Grail descended out of the sky, the Virgin got out of it, and she told Ferdinand IV would be forced to abdicate but would later be restored to power. The Umbertos, who had come out of God knows where in the south to become one of the richest banking families in Napoli, were suddenly arrested by the Dominicans and held incommunicado while rumors went hither and yon about incredible confessions concerning goat worship and infant sacrifice. Then a gang of drunks went down to the ghetto one night and began burning the Jews' shops. Ferdinand IV sent in the police, and the hooligans were arrested and sentenced to be dragged through town behind mules while being whipped by the public hangman, giving them air and exercise, that was called in popular speech. Maria Maldonado came home from the convent school for the summer, even lovelier than ever. Sigismundo suffered every time he saw her, because she was unaware of his existence, and because he could not stop having impure thoughts about her, and because whether this was love or lust did not matter, since it was impossible either way. She was a Maldonado. He was a Malatesta. He had more chance of a happy marriage, a passionate, novelistic romance, or even a one-night liaison with that naked stone Venus in Drake's garden. So it was a great relief when August came and he was able to go with Uncle Pietro on their long-planned trip to Rimini. Between the heat and the you-knows in the market and Maria, Napoli was becoming a continuing invitation to the sins of the flesh. The ostensible purpose of the journey was to expose Sigismundo to more of the operations of the family wine business. Actually, Pietro was much more concerned with showing the boy the Tempio Malatesta, the incredible architectural grotesque created by their infamous ancestor, Sigismundo Pandolfo Malatesta, in the 1440s, over 300 years ago. Nobody in Italy knew what to make of the Tempio Malatesta, nor of Sigismundo Pandolfo Malatesta himself, but Pietro never left any doubt that he was damned proud of both of them. He talked of the Tempio so often, in fact, that most of the Malatestas in Napoli were convinced he was even more glamorous than St. Peter's in Roma. Coach travel was new to Sigismundo, and by the time they were halfway through the journey, in Arezzo, he was beginning to think the coach was an instrument of torture invented to persuade wise people to stay home and let the bloody fools do all the traveling. The first day is exciting, he thought, all the new scenery to see. The second day is increasingly boring and uncomfortable. By the third day, you begin to suspect that you will never get your body into an uncramped posture again. When they stopped at Assisi, Pietro insisted on visiting the birthplace and shrine of San Francesco. This slightly surprised Sigismundo, who was growing increasingly doubtful about Uncle Pietro's orthodoxy. Too many trips to England, too many Masonic contacts, too many conversations with Protestants. But at the shrine, Pietro began reciting one of San Francesco di Assisi's poems, and he chanted with such fervor that the boy suddenly thought his enigmatic uncle was as pious as a Dominican, in his own odd way. One line in particular moved him. Nel fuoco d'amore mi mise. Into the fire of love, Sigismundo thought. It would be wonderful to be that close to God. He never felt that way in church, or in any of his efforts at prayer. Only music ever raised him to that perspective, where the fire of love was the most important fact about existence. Music and Maria Maldonado. And what he felt for music was profane, although permissible, while what he felt for Maria was probably sinful lust. If only he could feel that fire for God, he would be a saint like Francesco himself. He wished he was a saint in love with God instead of an artistic fool in love with the daughter of Count Maldonado. When they finally arrived in Rimini, it was a shock to see the Adriatic Sea. It was dark as wine, like Homer's Oinapa Ponton, and didn't have the coppery glitter of the Bay of Naples. And the people were strange, too, tall northerners, many of them blonde and red-haired, totally unlike Neapolitans, even though they spoke approximately the same language. If Sigismundo learned anything about the wine business on that trip, it did not stay with him for long. He was overwhelmed by the Tempio Malatesta and the horror that came after it. Of course, he had known the scandalous legend of the Tempio for years. Who in Italy did not know it? Sigismundo Pandolfo Malatesta was either the greatest man or the greatest monster of the 15th century, depending upon whose story you believed. The church had convicted him of atheism, parricide, incest, adultery, rape, sodomy, perjury, treason, sacrilege, and a few dozen miscellaneous heresies and atrocities. Those were all damned lies, Uncle Pietro said, slander created by Sigismundo Malatesta's enemies. Actually, incest or no incest, rape or no rape, sodomy or no sodomy, Sigismundo Pandolfo Malatesta, Prince of Rimini, was an extremist even by the standards of the uncouth times in which he lived. Almost every prince in Europe had had a war with the Pope by then, but they had always had the decency to claim they had a better Pope of their own. Keeping track of all the conflicting popes and anti-popes was the hardest part of the religious history class for Sigismundo Cellini. But Sigismundo Malatesta, his ancestor, boldly told the world that he didn't believe in the Pope, the Church, Jesus, or anything at all, except the atoms of Epicurus, the void in which the atoms are suspended, and his own will. He did not hide his mistresses either, as other princes did, but flaunted them openly, and year by year their numbers grew to equal any Turk's harem. The Tempio Malatesta had been built, in fact, to honor the last and best loved of Sigismundo's mistresses, Isciotta Degliati, whom he had finally married. It had not one Christian icon in it, but contained a monument proclaiming Divi Isciotta Sacrum, sacred to the divine Isciotta. When Isciotta died, Sigismundo Malatesta entombed her there, under a plaque saying, Isciotta of Rimini, in beauty and virtue, the glory of Italy. The rest of the temple was dedicated entirely to the gods of ancient Rome. If you can imagine a Barbary ape with pepper up his nose, Uncle Pietro said, you can imagine how Pope Pius II, reigning pontiff, jumped and howled and screamed when he found out about this heathen temple. When it was further reported that Sigismundo Malatesta had once filled the fonts of the Christian churches in Rimini with ink, so that he could stand in the streets and laugh at the ink-dabbed foreheads of the faithful as they returned from Mass, His Holiness had the apoplexy, the falling fits and blind staggers, as Uncle Pietro robustly expressed it. The war between Sigismundo Malatesta, Prince of Rimini, and Pope Pius II, Bishop of Roma, was won by the Pope, as everybody knew. And Sigismundo Malatesta did penance afterwards by serving 5 years as commander of the Venetian army and winning several victories against the Turks. A man must adapt to the facts of power, Uncle Pietro said, and besides, the Church is our great benefactor in this most enlightened and humane of all nations. Nonetheless, the Tempio Malatesta remained standing in Rimini, the one indisputably pagan shrine created in Italy since the triumph of Christianity. And Sigismundo Malatesta had imported the body of the philosopher Gemisto Plethon from Constantinople for re-entombment in the Tempio, honored equally with Isciotta Degliati, the gods of the pagans, and Sigismundo Malatesta himself. For Plethon was the last of the Gnostics who taught that the reality of religion was so mysterious that only a minority of illuminated men and women could ever understand it. Contemporary sources added that Sigismundo Malatesta wrote poetry, studied the Greek and Latin classics, and patronized numerous men of art and science, whose company he preferred to that of his fellow nobles. They also reported that the Prince of Rimini thought paganism more beautiful than Christianity, but the philosophy of Epicurus more true than either. That he was a Freemason, that he had said many times the Church went rotten as soon as bishops acquire huge estates, and started thinking like landlords, and that he once remarked, in the hearing of men of good repute, although he was admittedly more than a little inebriated at the time, that he almost believed his lips touched God's beatific essence only when he ran them over the body of the divine Isciotta degli Atti, and he had never experienced such holy awe when chewing the bread blessed by priests. Sigismundo Cellini was properly horrified, but also somewhat uncomfortably fascinated, by such a sinister ancestor. He was even more fascinated by the Tempio when he entered the fane and saw the heroic elephants leading inward to the halls of gold and beauty. "Took years for the masons to get those elephants right," Uncle Pietro said, but Sigismundo hardly heard him. He was transported right out of his body as if by a new Scarlatti sonata. He had never seen so much luminous jewelry and so many precious metals before. He had never seen such architecture in this Promethean megalomaniac mode before. And he had never seen so many unclothed female bodies before. The Tempio Malatesta was not dedicated to the pagan gods in general, he perceived. It was dedicated to Venus, the ideal female body. Mars was there, and Diana, and Jove, and others. But chiefly, it was Venus he saw, and another Venus, and another. All of them golden, glorious, provocatively offering their beauty. As shameless as whores, and yet as proud as musicians offering new symphonias. It was to the boy a temple of sensuality and nudity and satanic pride. Shame did not exist here. Modesty was forgotten and almost unimaginable. It was as if the artists had never known sin, or had been ordered by the Lord Malatesta to forget everything they ever heard on that subject. There was only flesh and light and joy, golden flesh and clear light, and pagan joy. And then Sigismundo Cellini came to Duccio's painting of his monster ancestor. Sigismundo Pandolfo Malatesta, egotist, anarchist, rebel, was portrayed unbelievably, kneeling before a statue of San Francesco di Assisi, his face upturned in rapt adoration. Was this an attempt to dilute the lewd paganism of the Tempio, a concession to the church, or did the Prince of Rimini have his own heathen, pantheistic reasons for honoring the saint who talked to the birds and wrote hymns to the sun? How many of the things written against my strange ancestor were true, Sigismundo Cellini wondered, and how much was, as Uncle Pietro said, the slander of his enemies? There was no way to answer that question, ever. Sigismundo Malatesta was lost, back there in the abyss of past time, 3 centuries ago. The verdict of his enemies got into the surviving chronicles. But the Tempio also survived, and in it something of the man remained, something that was not entirely monstrous. This architecture, these paintings and statues were like music, coherent in many dimensions. Sigismundo thought of Pythagoras and the Pythagorean secret society in ancient Italy. He remembered the legend that the Masons had secrets, geometrical and mystical teachings, preserved since the Pythagoreans, hidden formulas about Kabbalah and magic. These formulas were in all the great medieval and Renaissance buildings, it was said, but only another Freemason could decipher them. "Isn't she lovely?" Uncle Pietro said, pausing before a Venus with eyes that seemed alive after 300 years. "She was our ancestor. The artists were ordered to use Isciotta degli Atti's face on every image of the goddess." The eyes of Sigismundo Cellini's great-great-great-grandmother, or however many greats it took to go back 3 centuries, spoke to him from the canvas. Duccio had captured the woman's soul in her expression. She was as proud and shameless as her infamous consort. This whole building, whatever else it was saying, was a love poem in stone. It was announcing to all the world, for all centuries to come, to anybody who wandered in here looking for Renaissance culture or some insight into the bandit nobility of the 15th century, or just to get out of the sun. "Look, I, Sigismundo Pandolfo Malatesta, spent a fortune to build this because I loved a woman past all measure, past reason, past limits." The inquisitors claimed that Sigismundo Malatesta committed incest with his sister, poisoned his brother, raped a nun once. The temple said, "I loved beauty, He supervised every tiny detail, even writing long letters to the artist when he was away serving as a mercenary general to other princes. When he wanted to raise more money to make the Tempio even more outrageously stupendous, Uncle Pietro said. All the tracery, you will notice, consists of variations on the intertwining of his initial with hers, S and I. Sigismundo loves Isciotta. It resonated from every lovely statue and erotic painting to every soaring arch and illuminated column. Sigismundo Pandolfo Malatesta of Rimini made this monument of excess because he loves Isciotta and paganism and the Gnostics. And he doesn't give a flying French coitus for the Pope or Christianity, out of the most Catholic of all countries in the most Catholic of all centuries. Sigismundo Malatesta had created this symphony in marble and gold to hail his own private gods. Against all the laws of probability in history, the first pagan temple in 1,000 years. And he didn't even believe in God, Sigismundo Cellini said, bewildered by this glorification of those powers the church called lust and pride and sensuality. He had his own definition of God, Uncle Pietro said. To the popes, orthodoxy is God. To San Francesco, love was God. To the Dominicans, killing has become God. To our ancestor, Prince Sigismundo, whom I wished you to be named after, beauty itself was God. Toward the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being. Sigismundo Cellini remembered Cousin Antonio raving about Jesus being a woman. In his own way, while trying to get his three souls back together, Antonio had been trying to say what their ancestor had said in this building. It is not just in music, Sigismundo thought, where I first heard it. It can be in a building like this too. It is inside all of us. It can be the fire of love in which San Francesco had dwelt. Perhaps that is why the Lord Malatesta honored him. They were both consumed by the fire of love in different ways. And as he stood there, looking at nudity unashamed for the first time in his life, he was being consumed by fire too. Sigismundo Cellini carried away one further memory from the Tempio. On the tomb of his ancestor, Sigismundo Malatesta, the family motto, Tempus Locendi, Tempus Tecendi. There is a time to talk and a time to be silent. Uncle Pietro was always guided by that motto, he realized. On their way back to their inn, Sigismundo wondered about his uncle's connections with Freemasons and Jacobites and Rosicrucians, and about the Freemasonry of their sinister ancestor, Sigismundo Malatesta, and the proportions of music and Masonic buildings, and of the naked goddess, who was life and beauty and light in one. Of course, he thought, my diabolical ancestor was a great sinner, and Uncle Pietro is probably another, and Dr. Abraham Orfali is a Jew beyond doubt. So obviously, I am being seduced into heresy and perverted from the true faith. Obviously. But then, Father Ratti is probably a Mason too. Maybe I can learn to be whatever it is these men are and still remain a good Catholic. Uncle Pietro picked just the right moment to tell me I am named after that, Sigismundo. That is why he encourages my music. He knows it does not have to come out in architecture each time, but he wants it to come out again. Everything that happens is part of a process of gradual revelation that my genially Machiavellian uncle decided on before I was even born. He was too excited to resent that. Toward the one, the fire of love, Maria naked. He realized he was seeing everything with great clarity, as on Easter Sunday when the atrocity happened. This is a kind of shock, too. Time has been stretched out of joint, not by horror this time, but by ecstasy. It was in that heightened awareness that he realized he and Uncle Pietro were being followed. He wondered how to steal a peek at the stalker without being obvious. Meanwhile, he listened and used more subtle senses Tononi had hammered into him in fencing class. The follower was remaining about 10 yards behind and was large, large even for a northerner. Approaching an inn, they passed a row of shops. Sigismundo quickly said, "Oh, what's that?" and turned as if to look more closely in a window. He saw a row of silks, as gay as a tree full of parrots, but he also caught a glimpse of the stocking man, who was also stopping to look in another window. It was the blonde Sicilian who had provoked the quarrel between him and Carlo Maldonado. "Uncle," Sigismundo said softly.
"I know," Pietro replied quietly. "Keep your voice down."
"No, no, too expensive," he added loudly. They walked on. "That blonde man," Uncle Pietro said, "for 2 days now at least.
Don't jump like that. He is just one of Di Tanucci's boys. The secret police?
I do not think so. He is the one who almost got me into a duel with Carlo Maldonado."
"Very well," Pietro said. "He is a Rosso. He was one of the four in church last Easter. You didn't notice him then because you were busy wrestling the younger one with the violet eyes."
Sigismundo took a deep breath. "And why did you try to deceive me this time?"
"So that you wouldn't make a blazing idiot of yourself again."
"It is inspiring, the confidence everybody has in me." "And why do you not denounce him to the police, since you know he is one of the Rossi?" Sigismundo asked, still quietly. "How many chess games have you lost by making the obvious move? If he saw me walking toward a police building, he would vanish like the stars at sunrise. Meanwhile, the other one would still be on our trail."
"The other one?"
"Not so loud, damn it." Uncle Pietro took Sigismundo's arm and strolled on very casually. "There are always two on a surveillance team. One is careless, or so it seems. It is easy to spot him. The other is more subtle. All the tricks of mountebanks work the same way. You see something you think you were intended not to see, and then, while you are congratulating yourself on your shrewdness, the second trick, the real sting, goes right by you. Like the three-card game, where you think the queen turned over accidentally."
"Precisely. I have been trying to spot the second one for over a day now, and still he eludes me. I almost think they are violating the rules, and there is only the blonde man. But it is not safe to think that way. I keep watching."
But when they were back in their room at the inn, Uncle Pietro said, "I still haven't found the second one. Maybe I'm getting old. Anyway, they do not have assassination in mind this time, or they would have made their move by now. They have something else planned, and I hate to think of it. Damn, damn, I am sorry it has to start when you are still so young." Sigismundo remembered violet eyes looking into his own in San Francesco di Paola, clearly unwilling to kill him. He had never liked to think about that. "When are you going to tell me the truth about any of this?" he asked in exasperation.
"These are evil times, and this is a violent part of the world," Uncle Pietro said. "Knowledge, which should be the liberator of mankind, is a terrible burden instead. He who knows too much is in peril. I keep telling myself, wait, wait when he's a little older."
"If we are being stalked by assassins," Sigismundo said, "I think a little knowledge might not be as dangerous as total ignorance." But he was also afraid of what he might hear. Uncle Pietro went to the door and looked into the hall. When he returned, he moved two chairs to the point furthest from either the door or the window. Sigismundo half expected him to complete this performance by looking under the bed. But, after all, this is the land of the Inquisition, and what was coming was not going to be the kind of thing you would stand up and yell in the marketplace.
"My club is a big one," Pietro whispered. "The FRC. Our work is very dangerous, but it must be done. It is not something you do for glory or for profit. You do it for the reason our ancestor built the Tempio. Do you understand?"
"You are heretics," Sigismundo said very quietly. "I always knew it," he thought. "He has given me so many clues that anybody who could count the walls in the room wouldn't miss it. According to one pope long ago, we are heretics," Pietro said carefully. "One pope is not the whole church. You have Jews among you. Protestants also?"
Even Mohammedans, Pietro whispered. Father Ratti is one of you?
Yes, I knew it.
Does he think he is still a good Catholic, or is he just one of your spies within the church?
He is a good and pious Catholic. Abraham Orfali is a good and pious Jew. What we are doing is beyond sect. It is for all mankind.
That is heresy, Sigismundo said gravely.
Now I come to the moment of supreme temptation. He was right to keep it from me when I was younger.
Galileo was a heretic once, Pietro argued. The church changes and grows.
Can I go to confession ever again?
If I tell, you will all be arrested. If I do not tell, I will be in mortal sin.
Many of us go to confession and receive the sacraments, Pietro said. It is no sin to work for the enlightenment of mankind. It is no sin to keep quiet about things that will be misunderstood.
Tempus locendi, tempus tecendi.
That is sophistry, Sigismundo said. Heresy is sin. To protect heretics is sin. You can't change that with your merchant's clever word tricks. Papa said once that you could sell sand to the Arabs, but you can't sell me the line that this isn't heresy.
There was a pause. They looked away from each other.
You will denounce me, Pietro said finally.
This day and this moment will never come again, Sigismundo thought. What I decide now is forever.
I cannot denounce you, he said. I think I am a heretic myself and have been for a long time without knowing it.
When my second daughter was born, Pietro whispered, one outlaw to another, the midwife warned me. If we had any more children, my pretty Violetta would be in grave danger. I looked for years, trying to see a sign that my daughters had the power. They didn't. I love them. They are fine girls, but it doesn't always pass directly to one's children. It is part of our oath that we must pass the knowledge on to a child born with the power so it never dies out completely.
I thought only Strege had the power.
Many have it, in all nations. It is merely the habit of Dominicans to claim that anyone who shows it publicly is a Strege.
That is why I do not get along well with boys my age, not just because I am an artist.
Those with the power are always the lonely at first. Many misuse it, become Strege or worse. The FRC is to teach how it should be used as God intended it.
It is also where my music comes from?
Of course, you are growing toward the fourth soul.
Why am I such a fool so often then?
It is that way, Pietro said with a grimace.
Our ancestor had the power in very large measure, as you could see in the Tempio. He squandered his wealth to build that one beautiful edifice. He got into dozens of stupid wars, declared his opinions openly, virtually forced the Pope to excommunicate him. He died nearly bankrupt, a considerable feat for a man born so rich. Without guidance, we do not use the power, Siggy. It uses and abuses us.
Sigismundo sighed. And how do Drake and the Jacobites fit into this, if his name really is Drake?
Oddly enough, it is Drake. Robert Francis Drake, descended from the famous pirate, he says. As for the Jacobites, they are Freemasons too, but few of them have reached the rank of the FRC, lowering his voice still further on the initials.
What is the goal of Masonry?
Brotherhood, peace. To put an end to the damn fool wars that have torn Europe apart.
And the goal of the FRC?
That is harder to describe in ordinary language. It is concerned more with the inner world than the outer.
And why was Uncle Leonardo killed, and why are we under surveillance?
There is more than revolution in this, right?
The Alumbrados have their own ideas about the power, and who should use it, and how it should be used. Your Uncle Leonardo was one of us, the FRC. Like the Inquisitors, the Alumbrados wish us abolished, exterminated. If possible, they would like even the record of our existence expunged, so that none would know the power but themselves.
Sigismundo remembered Father Ratti talking of mind control, strange drugs,
powers that were not flesh and blood, he involuntarily made the sign of the cross.
Yes, Pietro said, you have heard enough for now. Some things will have to wait until you are older.
Sigismundo did not protest. He had a deep, crawly sensation that there were some secrets he did not want to confront yet.
In Arezzo, on the way home, Sigismundo saw the blonde Sicilian again, just once, but he suddenly realized that every face on every street is as incomprehensible a mystery as the dogma of the Holy Trinity. You have no idea what any of them are really thinking or planning. You are alone, completely alone, and always vulnerable. This quiet man, who does not even seem to notice you, might be an assassin who has been waiting for you to pass this way. More strange and terrible, you do not even know what the harmless ones are thinking. This unfriendly, irritable woman may be mourning a dead child. This cheerful man may have been maddened by the French pox and thinks he is Cato the Elder. Suddenly, the whole street was foreground, and he, Sigismundo, was just background. No, he was hardly there at all. An overwhelming sense of the reality and fragility of the world descended upon him. It was huge. It was full of people. All of them were different. And all were important to themselves. Millions came. Millions passed. Millions died. And Sigismundo Celline was not the center of all creation by any means. I am lost in the mass and vertigo of everything that is not me, he thought. I am, somehow, outside this world looking in, and it is all glass and spinning rapidly and it shatters easily. He felt the horror coming closer and knew he would find part of the secrets Uncle Pietro had not told him very soon and very unpleasantly. The torrid dog days were over when they returned. Napoli was enjoying its usual balmy climate again. Come walk in the garden, Father Ratti said one day. Sigismundo accompanied the Jesuit to the Sacred Heart Garden, wondering what was coming now. Ever since you asked me about the Jacobites, Father Ratti said, I've been remembering a song about the Battle of Culloden Moor. I thought you might find it interesting, since it is the kind of English that the Scots speak. It is not at all like ordinary English. His face was bland as that of a three-card Monte artist. Ratti opened a book of English verse and read, Lament for Culloden. It was a dramatic monologue about the sufferings of the Scots at the hands of the English army. Sigismundo was especially moved by the last stanza. Now way to thee, thou cruel lord. A bluidy man I trow thou be, and mony a heart thou hast made sour, that ne'er did rang to thine or thee. It is indeed unlike ordinary English, Sigismundo said awkwardly, waiting for the trap to be sprung. Then he blurted, It is most stark and tragic. I hate the world for being that way. All decent men hate it, Father Ratti said. The question is, how do we change it? Life is one test after another, Sigismundo thought. Who is the man denounced in the closing lines, the cruel lord? He asked, stalling for time. Ratti is one of them, a Jesuit, but a heretic too. William, Duke of Cumberland, the priest replied, and in the guise of further historical background to the song, returned to his real theme. He was indeed a bluidy man. After the victory, he pursued the clans who had supported Bonnie Prince Charlie back to their hills and homesteads. All members of these clans were killed, even those who had not joined the rebellion. Several clans were exterminated down to the last man, woman, and child. Infants were not spared. William's troops were given free rein to burn every barn, every house, every granary they passed. Thousands of women were raped. Children were bayoneted to death. We have no word for this, my child. It was the murder of a whole culture, a people, a way of life. Do you understand?
It is sickening, Sigismundo said bitterly. And it was not madness or blind fury, the Jesuit went on, his mouth as tight as that of a Dominican discussing Voltaire. The English crown had decided to teach a lesson in reality to the Scots, as the Roman Senate decided to teach a lesson to the slaves after the Spartacus uprising by crucifying 50,000 men along the Via Appia. This is the truth of history, my child. This is what government is all about. This is what power means. I hate it, Sigismundo repeated. I thought such monstrosities happened only in primitive ages. The crown was most pleased with William of Cumberland, the Jesuit went on. They actually named a flower after him. Isn't that touching? It is called Sweet William. The Scots have never accepted the name. They call it Stinking Billy. So now I know what the Jacobites are, Sigismundo thought. They are the survivors of a Holocaust. Such things are more common than you realize, Sigismundo, Bratti said. History texts are not chosen by disinterested scholars seeking only the truth. They're chosen by government censors. I know of no subject more likely to destroy one's faith in the moral order of the universe than the true record of what princes and prime ministers have done. Sigismundo was now sure he knew where all this was leading. Suppose there was one group only concerned with truth and justice, he said abruptly. They would be abused and denounced by the fanatics of all parties, is that not so? Undoubtedly, the Jesuit said carefully. Such a group would have to include men of all nations, Sigismundo went on. There would be both Catholics and Protestants among them, and even Jews and Muslims. It could be. That would make them heretics, Sigismundo said bluntly. Let us have it out in the light of day, he thought. If they were condemned by an ecclesiastical court, and if they remained obdurate, the Jesuit said precisely, they would certainly be heretics. Since that has not happened into the, hypothetical group we are imagining, it is for each man to search his conscience in the matter and decide if it is heresy or not. When I say, search the conscience, I mean nothing casual, I hope you realize. One must be totally sure of one's sincerity and the rightness of one's course. One must not act out of vanity or childish romanticism. Do you understand? Thank you, Father, Sigismundo said. I always find your talks on religious knowledge most helpful. He was thinking, are the Jesuits a stalking horse for the Jacobites, or are the Jacobites a tool for the Jesuits, or does the FRC run both of them? And, no wonder the Jesuits have been expelled from so many nations. Nobody knows what they are really plotting. They are as enigmatic as a cat's eyes. The horror came quite unexpectedly one day as he was returning from school, just after the beginning of the autumn term. He had found a shortcut lately, an alley between two palazzi that saved nearly 5 minutes of circular, uphill huffing and puffing. That day, a Thursday it was, he saw the blonde man again in the alley ahead of him. And so there was the exquisite pleasure of stalking the stalker, spying on the spy, through one alley after another, across this palazzo and that garden after that garden and another palazzo, proud of his skill and stealth, never thinking of who might be stalking him more skillfully, more stealthily. The blonde man finally entered a seedy, run-down inn with peeling paint and dirty windows, the kind of place patronized only by the poor. Sigismundo lounged in a doorway and watched. Others entered the inn, and they had the look of Rossi about them. Peasants, yes, but peasants without humility, with rage and violence in their faces. They were the kind of men who would sell you their daughters for 2 lire, slit a throat for 5 lire, dump the archbishop in the bay, well weighted down, for a florin. The sane, sensible thing to do at this point, he realized, would be to remember the name of this place, Osteria Dante, and report it at once to Drake in the palace. That was obvious. So naturally, he found a way to enter the garden from the other side and climb the wall of the adjoining coffee house. From the roof, he quickly made the jump to the roof of the inn. He had entered enemy territory unobserved. Now he might really have something to tell Drake, if he saw them before they put their hoods on. There were 1,001 potted plants,
as on any roof in Napoli, he found his way among them to the staircase. He inhaled, held the breath to the count of four, exhaled to the count of eight. He was empty and emotionless. He stepped onto the staircase, then paused. The only sounds were from the tavern. "Young musician exposes revolutionaries." It would be in the journals all over Italy. He descended slowly. As he expected, the second floor landing led to a hall that passed him to a balcony above the tavern. He crept forward to the balcony. There were 13 men in the tavern, the same number as comprises a witch's coven, and the street door was bolted. They were hooded already. Their solid black again reminded him of a caricature of a religious order. Black candles were being lit on the walls. The tallest man, the blonde Siciliano Sigismundo guest, raised a dagger to the north, east, south, west. "Tana, who is our green mother," he intoned solemnly. "Orpheus, who is our golden comforter. Aradia, who is our blue skies. Lucifer, who is our red rage." Uncle Pietro and his friends did not know the whole invocation, or would not say it even to frighten me, Sigismundo thought. Tana, Orpheus, Aradia, Lucifer, all chorused. What is the first duty of a master mason? My God, he thought, they actually do think they are the real Freemasons. To see that the baracca is secure. From then on, it followed the formula Pietro's friends had used to hoax him, until suddenly a statue was unveiled and all cried, "Magna Mater, Magna Mater, Magna Mater." It was a naked goddess, but not beautiful at all, not like the ones in the Tempio Malatesta. She had no face, no eyes, no nose, and was grotesquely fat, with huge breasts. Somehow looking at her, Sigismundo knew she was incredibly old, older even than Sicily. "Mother Tana, who is the woods and the wind and the silvery stars," the tall man chanted. "Mother Tana, who is the woods and the wind and the silvery stars," all chorused. "Mother Tana, who wishes all of her children to be free and equal. Mother Tana, who wishes all of her children to be free and equal. Mother Tana, who gives birth in blood, whose sacrament is blood, whose regeneration is blood. Mother Tana, who gives birth in blood, whose sacrament is blood, whose regeneration is blood." They do have a demented Gothic poetry about them, Sigismundo thought. "Conx om pax," intoned the leader. "This session of the temple of the East is now open." "What is the first order of business, Ael Aswad?" asked the voice. "We must bring down our uninvited guest on the balcony," Ael Aswad said. Sigismundo leaped to his feet immediately, but four men had quietly come down onto the balcony behind him, and he was seized before he could draw his sword. Heroism is the admirable quality we attribute to damned fools who have survived their follies, he remembered Uncle Pietro saying, and, when you think you see what the magician does not intend you to see. Rough hands dragged him rapidly down the stairs, banging his head brutally against the wall every time he struggled to break free. He was dizzy and his scalp was bleeding when he arrived in the center of the circle. This was no joke this time. If they all enjoyed a good hearty laugh afterwards, it would be while they cleaned up the bloodstains. They released him after taking his sword. He was surrounded and every hand held a dagger. His heart was pounding wildly again. "Maybe I'll get used to it," he thought. "If I get out of this alive by divine intervention, maybe, and keep on getting into messes, I might eventually notice only the times when my heart isn't banging like a bass drum at the opera." He looked about him. The eyes behind the hoods were cold and black and about as jovial as a pit of cobras. The black candles created an ideal atmosphere for human sacrifice, and they would probably chant more heathen invocations while they sliced him up. He looked again at Mother Tana. She was indeed unbelievably old and had been carved with primitive tools many aeons ago. She might date back to the time Dr. Vico wrote of,
when men were mute giants and lived in caves. A hero would leap to the table like greased lightning, bound quickly up the chandelier, swing across to the window, and crash out into the street. Somehow, Sigismundo thought, I don't think I'm quite that good yet.
Greetings, brave little musician, Eil Aswad said with a mockery of aristocratic speech.
Greetings, great big brave rebels who slash and stab when there are four of you against one unarmed man, Sigismundo replied.
Uncle Pietro and his friends prepared me for this scene, he thought. I will not pee in my pants. I will die like a man, no matter how my heart pounds.
Note those R's, Eil Aswad said with mock geniality. Only a true aristocrat can roll them like that. They practice all day, except when they are busy foreclosing mortgages. A son any man would be proud of.
You are going to spare me again, Sigismundo blurted. He didn't know why he said it or how he knew it.
There was a murmur of astonishment among the hooded figures.
It is as I proclaimed, Eil Aswad announced pontifically. He has the baraka, do you see? He is one of us.
I have the power sometimes, Sigismundo said, but I will never be one of you, you filthy butchers.
You will learn, Eil Aswad said, and then he removed his hood, reminding Sigismundo of the time the scene was only a joke.
The head that emerged was the blonde man's, as Sigismundo expected.
None of the others repeated the same indiscretion, which meant they were indeed going to spare Sigismundo. That was why he would not see their faces.
Look at me, boy, Eil Aswad said. You will join us someday, and you will do it of your own free will, because you will come to understand our divine work in this world.
Never, Sigismundo said. I hate you and your murders.
We have the Mason word and second sight. Things yet to come, we can see aright, Eil Aswad quoted.
I see you wearing my hood someday, Eil Aswad pronounced with absolute certitude.
You will travel to many countries and cross the ocean. You will flee your true nature in every way. But eventually, you will come to us.
A hooded figure spoke in a youngish voice.
Brother, it is true. You are one of us. You were born under the stars that made you one of us.
He was the one with the violet eyes.
They really believe it, Sigismundo thought. That is why they spared me in the church on Easter. I am in the hands of fanatics who kill one man by the conjunctions of two planets and spare another by the trines of two others.
You murdered my uncle. I would sooner join the foul Mohammedans.
As for that, Eil Aswad said, you have already joined the foul Mohammedans. Where do you think the real control of the FRC comes from?
The younger voice spoke again, those violet eyes staring passionately at Sigismundo through the slits in the hood.
It is not murder to fight for what was stolen from you by violence. Killing and more killing is what history is made of. What is the story of your glorious Catholic Church but butchery and more butchery? Against the pagans first, then against the Jews, then the Mohammedans, then the Protestants. What is the history of Napoli and Sicily but butchery? How did our gracious majesty, Ferdinand IV, come to rule us, except that his French and Spanish ancestors butchered our ancestors?
So it has been, and so it will be, until all priests and governors are killed and we are all free brothers together.
Every national border in Europe, Eil Aswad added ironically, marks the place where two gangs of bandits got too exhausted to kill each other anymore and signed a treaty. Patriotism is the delusion that one of these gangs of bandits is better than all the others.
And you will change all that through more butchery? Sigismundo exclaimed.
You are destroyed by the French pox. It is gone to your brains.
Listen, Violet Eyes said. Your wonderful uncle we killed. He was a heartless usurer.
There are 100 beggars who were once farmers before they got into debt to your lovely uncle, Eil Aswad said.
There are 200 whores who would be leading virtuous lives as farm girls now if the farms had not been foreclosed by your noble uncle.
I will explain, Sigismundo said reasonably. You are uneducated men. My uncle was most generous, most kindly. But when a man lends money and the money is not returned, he must collect the warranty. Otherwise, he will be the beggar and his daughters will be the whores. It is the science of economics. It is in books.
It is the science of murder and banditry, Eyal Aswad said. Enough of this chatter. Nobody is convinced by mere words. You will come to us eventually. It is written in the heavens. You will learn that we are the wave of the future.
Never, Sigismundo repeated hotly. I will piss in the milk of your mothers first. I will fuck your eyes. I will damn you to the stinking bottom cesspool of hell.
Eyal Aswad merely turned and said, Bring the cup. The ritual begins.
Sigismundo was forced into a chair, and a cup was brought. Oh, Mother of God, no, he thought. They wouldn't kill him. The power was real, and he trusted it. But there were some things worse than death. They knew how to put him to sleep, as Dr. Orfali did, and work on his mind. Oh, bleeding Jesus, no, he prayed. Let them kill my body and leave my soul alone. Dear Jesus, don't let them poison my very being with drugs and black magic. Please, Jesus, please.
It took eight of them, but finally his jaws were pried open. He went on struggling. He spat out as much of it as he could. He prayed to St. Jude, patron of hopeless cases, and none of it helped in the slightest. They got a large portion of the drug down his throat. In a few seconds, his heart was pounding so fast he thought he might die of it. He was trembling all over, and then he began to have violent spasms, like a man with a falling sickness. It was as if he was freezing and being boiled in oil all at once. That is the primitive vegetative soul, he told himself. Dr. Orfali uses a drug that pacifies that soul, but they are using one that throws it into emergency. My body feels fear and impending death, but my mind, my human soul, knows better. It is only a drug agitating the vegetative part of the psyche. I can detach myself from it by remembering it is only a drug. I can. I think I can.
Then they released him, and Eyal Aswad said, Now the magic begins to work in you. Now the old gods return. And then Sigismundo noticed that King Ferdinand had been hiding in a corner all along, and His Majesty raised his royal purple scepter and chanted like a priest at high mass, To bugger Anthos, let this charge be given, and let them bugger all things under heaven. And the black candles suddenly became yellow, and soon there were fireworks and flying cockroaches, pinwheels and rockets, a vertigo of rainbows, and they were all soaring through the air. Sigismundo and Eyal Aswad and Uncle Pietro and Don Quixote, some of them already turned into birds. And he realized he almost knew the worst secret, the one they had been hiding from him since birth. And the gorilla, with testicles for eyes and a rotten leper's nose, said, The clash of our cries for peace, or say that stone is the speech, do not murmur, nor know. For the lions. And then he saw his hands getting older and older, bent and splotched and wrinkled. Old man's hands. And he thought, They are moving me ahead in time. I am locked in this home for the mindless forever. But no, he told himself, that is a hallucination. It was a long time ago that somebody gave me a drug, and I'm still hallucinating. And they pricked Sigismundo's finger, using his blood as the ink. It didn't seem to matter, out here among the dead planets, with the vegetable people. And then he threw the pen across the room, refusing to sign. Now, repeat after me, Eyal Aswad said. Unto Lucifer I pledge my soul, for this lifetime and all future lifetimes. Repeat. But the further down they went, the more of the horned, dog-faced things Sigismundo noticed. The ceilings were getting lower. Eventually they were crawling on all fours. The horrible smell, Sigismundo decided, was batshit. He was crawling in the filthy stuff. I don't understand, Reverend Verri said. A chicken in the Vatican? Looking at it rationally, Sigismundo decided that it was a good idea to get rid of his clothes and put on these animal skins. No sense getting batshit all over your best silks, he told himself. Still, he didn't exactly remember putting on the bearskin he was wearing. "Unto Lucifer I pledge my soul," Ael Aswad repeated. Sigismundo had the pen again, wet with his own blood.
"Just sign here," Ael Aswad said gently.
Sigismundo signed the parchment. Bells tolled solemnly. A million damned souls screamed in horror. Giant spiders rushed about devouring citizens on the streets.
"I don't have to believe any of this," Sigismundo told himself. "I didn't sign. This is hallucination."
The reptile men groveled in worship to the faceless goddess, and the wheels interlocked and he was on a collision course. Religious fanatics raving about earthquakes, last product of moon ash and blood septums. When we came out of the mud like crippled monkeys, strictly from insect. And Sigismundo noticed that the cave walls were decorated with paintings, mostly showing men in bearskins like himself, shooting arrows at bisons. And then he saw a painting of a man sleeping with an erect penis, and after they got to the bottom, gorillas and bishops fighting in the dung. The man with goat horns was waiting for them, and the statue of Mother Tana had fresh blood on it from a goat lying with its throat cut, and the voices said, "They'll all go mad in that house, they'll all go mad in that house, they'll all go mad in that house." Sigismundo realized he had been in this room for many years. His whole sense of time had been warped. He only imagined he was still in the cave with the mute giants. They had destroyed his mind. And he was in this home for the feeble-minded for decades and decades, his hands wrinkled and corpse-like, growing older, and he had to stop hallucinating so the doctors would release him and let him go home.
"Step on the crucifix now," Ael Aswad said.
"Noses and noses," Sigismundo screamed. "I mean, no. Why can't I say no?"
They lifted his foot and placed it down hard on the crucifix. Jesus, tiny as he was, screamed in pain and blood spurted up Sigismundo's boot. And then another demon was sodomizing him. He remembered in shame and horror that he had been raped many times already. That was another hallucination, he told himself. I must believe it is a hallucination. But the demon had leathery wings and scaly skin, and his foul breath was hot on Sigismundo's neck. But the tree people were mocking him, repeating over and over, "Your mother is a whore, your mother is a whore, your mother is a whore." And he knew that was the secret, but it couldn't be. And he was with Miska Squamish at the golden springs of the Wakan, because the creatures of this Bulgia lacked eyes, and Dante was being eaten alive by them. But that could happen to any artist. Do not call up any that you cannot put down.
"Of course," Sigismundo said to the devil reasonably, "I am no longer a human being. That is the secret, right? I am glad I signed that contract with you, sir, and I'm sure my immortal soul is in good hands now. Antonio and I are the same person, but not the same apostle."
Ael Aswad was still chanting, "Tana before you, Orpheus behind you, Aradia at your right side, Lucifer at your left side." Then he came very close and looked right into Sigismundo's eyes again. "You see our four gods," he said, "but now look within and find the creator of all gods." Sigismundo turned to fire and light. He understood suddenly that the Rossi were his friends after all. Everybody was his friend. It was worth all the terror of transition to arrive at this ecstasy. The whole world adored him. He became the whole world, god and goddess, male and female, human and animal, life and death. They had made him emperor of the universe. The walls were pornographic. Winged penises flew through the gardens, and young ladies chased them. Some had captured a few and were raptly sucking on them, eyes closed in bliss like nuns at prayer. Sigismundo looked around groggily. He was back in his own clothes again, but the bearskin was thrown in a corner. The adjoining wall was an orgy. Permutations and combinations like mathematics. How could they do all that with only 12 bodies?
All is permissible, he thought. I am the emperor of the universe. I will run up the hill and fuck Maria at once. Then, with a snap, things came into focus again. He realized that he was in Pompeii. A woman in one of the murals began to move, inviting him to join the orgy. Sigismundo stared at her, willing the hallucinations to go away. She stopped moving. The first real shock came when he started to stagger toward the door. There was graffiti on the walls, part of the evil glamour of Pompeii, ancient obscenities, but he could not read the letters. He tried again and again. It was all a blur. Part of his mind had been destroyed by what the Rossi had done to him. He had lost the human soul. He was as illiterate as a newborn or an animal. He lurched into the street, fighting against despair. The Orsini family had a child with a huge head deformed. He was 16 or 17 now, but still a baby. He could not read or feed himself and spoke only in terrible, pitifully slurred grunts. Sigismundo wondered if the devil drug had done that to him, if he would be like that for the rest of his life, chained in a room and hallucinating, watching his hands turn old and wrinkled. All of Gaul is divided into three parts, he said aloud in Latin, testing himself. His speech was normal. And then, set sail upon the wine-dark sea, he tried in Greek. The human soul was not destroyed. It was just that his eyes were out of focus. He saw an ancient street sign, Via Gracchi. He could read large letters. It was only the small ones that were blurred. Belladonna, the Greek drug. His pupils were dilated, obviously. He had not lost his literacy. When women put belladonna in their eyes to look beautiful at the opera, they could not see small things either. He found the sun and started the trek westward and downward, back to Napoli. His memory of last night was full of holes. That, too, was the effect of the belladonna. He would never remember all of it. He could remember only going down into a very deep cave and seeing Carlo Maldonado point a pistol at him. His right index finger was sore. He looked at it and saw many prick marks. He almost remembered how that happened, but then the memory disappeared into chaos and confusion. Gradually, his eyesight returned to normal. He kept checking his palms, and eventually he could see every line clearly. Every 10 minutes or so he had to stop, because the world would spin and he couldn't walk straight for a while. A peasant from Otticelli, driving an ox cart, gave him a ride part of the way. He kept looking at Sigismundo dubiously. Maybe he can see that I am not in all respects rational right now, Sigismundo thought. Sigismundo did not go directly home. He went to Uncle Pietro's house on Via Capodimonte. Where have you been? Pietro demanded at once. The whole family. Never mind that, Sigismundo said. I just spent a hilarious evening with Rossi. I know the secret. Who is my father? Uncle Pietro sat down wearily. I knew this day would come, he said. I knew too, Sigismundo said. The reason I was always closer to you. Papa is strained with me. I am not his child, am I? Listen, Pietro said. You must not be too harsh on your mother. That beast forced her. Never mind that either. Who is my father? The blonde man, the assassin from the church. His name is Peppino Balsamo. And you kept it from me for my own good, of course? So, I am Sigismundo Balsamo, not Sigismundo Celline. The common people are lazy and ignorant, he quoted himself bitterly, and I am one of them. Sweet Christ, I am a bleeding Siciliano, even. I am a Sicilian's bastard. My mother has been in hoard. My father murdered my uncle, and everybody I know is involved in one conspiracy or another. We are living in the lives of the Caesars. Stop it. Get a grip on yourself. There is a chicken in the Vatican. What? You wouldn't understand, Sigismundo said.
There are tunnels, vast systems of tunnels underneath Europe, and things haven't changed at all. After Culloden, they murdered the infants. Moloch rules still. Antonio was right about time. But who was the other, the one with the violet eyes, who would not kill me in church? He is Balsamo's son also, by another woman in Sicily. Your half-brother. Yes, he called me brother. I thought it was revolutionary rhetoric. Splendid, Sigismundo said. Most marvelous and lovely entirely. I have been born in the middle of a grand opera, but we bleed real blood. Do you wish to hear the latest, the cream of the jest? The tunnels go down, under the earth, but also backward into earlier ages. But no, that is not it. What you should know is that they want to recruit me. Isn't that hilarious? Peppino Balsamo, I mean, my father, the one who arranges murders when he isn't plotting revolutions. You know, the real one. Not the one who married my mother. Not that weak sister who lets strange birds foul his nest. Stop it. No, Sigismundo said, you must hear it. My real father, the devil worshipper, says the stars have picked me to succeed him. And I will agree of my own free will, he says. And to tell you the truth, uncle, I'm not at all sure I have any free will left after last night. I don't know what they did to my head, but my mother is a whore, and Jesus is a naked woman, and I see huge chickens driving the popes out of the Vatican. I tell you, my three souls are all sick, and I know in the future that I will be the worst of all monsters.
Part 2. The Empress. Cruelty has a human heart, and jealousy a human face, terror the human form divine, and secrecy the human dress. William Blake, A Divine Image. Liliana Cellini thought she was lying when she told Guido that Peppino Balsamo had raped her. Because it was not rape, at least as she understood rape, even though it was not seduction either. There was no romance, no passion. But Guido could never understand what actually happened, since Liliana had no words to explain it at the time. Nobody, she thought often as the years passed and Sigismundo grew, nobody anywhere in God's world could understand it. There was no reason in it anywhere. It was simply the kind of deviltry that inexplicably happened whenever a thing like Peppino was loosed in the world. It took half her adult life before she understood that she had not lied to Guido, that it really was rape, rape of the mind. She had loathed Peppino from the beginning. He was insolent and cruel to animals, and he obviously hated her and Guido for being rich. But that was only part of it. Basically, it was her intuition of what Peppino was and what he could do, what he might do, that made her wary of him. Guido had hired Peppino to do some carpentry. He was very good with his hands, all kinds of repair work. Guido kept him on for several weeks, having many small jobs done, because he was so quick and clever at such things. Liliana wanted to discharge him from the first day because of his arrogance and the bad way he treated the animals, and his insolence. He thought he could have any woman he wanted. His eyes showed it when he looked at her. And he made coarse jokes, implying that he had seduced even noble women. His confidence, his conceit, was unbearable. So Liliana kept asking Guido to discharge the man, and Guido didn't understand. Men never understand such things. Not normal men, anyway. Only monsters like Peppino Balsamo understood. Guido thought she disliked the tall Sicilian with the sulky good looks because he did not have the humility of the average peasant. That was the irony of it. Guido assumed until it was too late, that she was just being a snob, an 18-year-old girl married only 2 years, accustomed to being protected from the world by her brothers, the mighty Malatestas, who were almost as rich as the Maldonados. He thought she was vain and silly to be so upset that a peasant who was smarter than the average was also a bit uppity. "The bright ones are always troublesome," Guido told her. But at last, thank the saints, Peppino left. There was no repair work to be done, and Guido finally realized how much Liliana feared the man, even though he still did not know why. Not then. Because you can look at the sky sometimes and know a storm is coming, far away, or you can look at a dog and know it is vicious. That really was what Guido could not comprehend. Liliana had looked at Peppino that first hour, when he was fixing the broken leg of the kitchen table, and had known he had had it in him to leave a town where he had been wronged, or imagined himself wrong, and he would leave very quietly, with nothing said, and he would stay away many years, until everybody forgot him, forgot his name, forgot his face, forgot that Peppino Besalmo had ever been there, and then he would come back, only once, at night, and kill a small child of the man he thought had wronged him, and vanish again, nobody but himself to understand the motive of the atrocity. It would be like a stroke of lightning, and only he would know he was lightning. If they made him a general, she knew, he would tell his troops, "Kill them all, the children too, destroy the village down to the last pig, the last stray dog, leave no brick standing on a brick." Without compunction. It was absurd, too, that he had a name like Peppino. But it was clever for a demon to pass himself off in the world as just another Peppino, your standard average peasant. There must be as many Peppinos in Napoli, she thought, as there are stars in the sky or fleas in a stable. Peppino this and Peppino that, everywhere, hundreds of thousands of them, not just in Napoli, but all over Italy. And among them, one alone, this demon with enough hatred to fill the hundreds of thousands. In Spain, she thought, it is Pablo. In England, it is Bill or Will. In France, it is Pierre. Here, it is Peppino. Maybe that is why he became a monster, so he would not get lost among all those Peppinos, all those servile peasant faces. And so, when he left, Liliana thanked God, the Holy Virgin, and Saint Gennaro that the outrage would happen somewhere else. But then, next summer, when Guido was in Spain on business, Peppino returned. He came to the back door, of course, and took off his hat. Even he could pretend a courtesy when it was in his interest. Liliana told him there was no work. He smiled at her. It was more like a shark showing its teeth. He said it was obvious that her husband was away, and she was afraid of him because she thought all peasants were brutes. She tried to be brave. She told him there were 5 servants in the house, and that if he made another insolent remark, she would have him horsewhipped. But she was still only 18, and too well-bred to know how a clever liar can get around you. Peppino stood there in the garden and apologized, most abjectly. It almost seemed as if he might weep. He said that he had no work in a long time and that he had a family to support. He told her that she had humiliated him because there are always a few odd jobs for a man with his mechanical and manual talents. He said that when he realized she was afraid of him, he was pained and lost his head, and that a fine, rich lady like her could not imagine how hard life was for a poor man with a wife and 3 children. He apologized over and over. And then he asked Liliana if she knew of any neighbors who might have odd jobs they needed done. She didn't believe him, not really. But he made her doubt herself. He wondered if she was just a silly snob and perhaps had wronged this hulking giant who now seemed so desperate for honest work. Maybe, she thought, she was afraid of him only because a peasant who can read and write, she had learned that about him last winter, is something strange. Like a dog walking on its hind legs. With 2 male servants in the house and 3 maids to scream for help, Peppino would not do anything, certainly, and her fears were childish. and she thought of his wife and family. She was uncertain, and that made her vulnerable. She decided to give him a few small jobs and some coins and be rid of him. So she let him in. And then it began in earnest, the struggle for power in her own household. She, the noble lady with all the weight of tradition and the police to help her if she called for help. He, the homeless and propertyless man with seemingly no power but his brute strength, which he dared not use, of course. And yet she was the one who was on the defensive, always. Everything she did or said was taken as an insult. He was not angry again, and he did not complain openly, but he let her know. She was rich, and he was poor, and she was afraid of him because she was a silly girl who didn't trust peasants. Somehow she had to prove, not to Peppino, but to herself, or to God maybe, that she wasn't the cruel, prejudiced, cowardly girl woman he had made her seem. Later, she finally understood. Everybody knows about the tyranny of the powerful, but there is something worse, and Peppino knew how to use it. It is worse because you cannot understand it. You feel too guilty to fight it, and you cannot even define it until it has taken what it wants from you. It is the tyranny of the suffering. Peppino suffered, and suffered, and suffered some more. And every chance he got, Liliana heard more about his children, his great love for them, the hardships of his life, the life of a peasant too independent to work somebody else's farm, too proud to join the professional beggars on the street, a man forced to live by his wits for the crumbs of life. More and more, it became a trial in which she had to prove that she was not personally responsible for his suffering, or for the suffering of all the poor people in the world. She didn't know which offense was worse, or more her fault, but he had those two injustices firmly identified in his mind, and then in hers. Liliana never did really pity him. Still, she distrusted him. But she was unsure and felt increasingly guilty about distrusting him. She found she could not bring herself to tell him that all the work was done. That would be another sign of her cruelty, the cruelty of her class, not just to Peppino Besalmo, but to all the Peppinos everywhere. So she kept finding new work for him, afraid of the accusation that would be in his eyes when she told him to go. And she kept hoping Guido would come home from Spain. And every week, Peppino told her that he sent his wages to his wife and children, and that they were all praying for her because she was such a kind and charitable woman. Somehow, he made it sound as if kindness and charity were two more insults, two more abuses she was heaping on him. Somehow, it became a question of how close he could get to her, how close she would allow him to be without showing her anxiety. She feared him still, but he had made her ashamed of her fear, because there is an area around the body that is like a second skin. When you let somebody inside that space, you are intimate with them. We let only our family get that close, normally, and yet she could not keep Peppino out of the space, not without thinking she was a fool and a snob and personally uniquely responsible for every hungry child in Napoli, for every injustice committed since the followers of Spartacus had been crucified. Then he persuaded her that the chimney in the bedroom fireplace needed repairing, and after that he made her know that if she avoided the bedroom while he was in there hacking and plastering, it would be another prejudiced condemnation of an honest, hard-working man. And so they came to the moment, staring at each other, an inexplicable flicker of fear in even his eyes for one brief second, and then it happened. In a courtroom, she knew, she could not honestly say that he forced her, but it was not voluntary either. It was the storm she had sensed when she first saw him. His rage, and his lust, and his need to seize the world and be its master, that was all part of it. And her fear, and her guilt, and, most of all, her attempts to convince herself that she was not merely acting from fear and guilt. It was not lovemaking, just as it was not, legally speaking, rape. But it was an explosion, as if all the poor people in the world brought their suffering and resentment into that bed, and she had to give them all she could give to make them leave, to take that suffering somewhere else. Somehow, she was proving to him that she did not think of peasants as animals. Somehow, letting him use her as a receptacle was the only proof she had left. Perhaps she was trying to bribe him, the way one tries to bribe one's conscience at times. He had become conscience and rage and judge and executioner, all in one. Guido would never understand, neither would her clever brother Pietro, who understood so much. No normal man would understand. Only other women might know, other women and those who prey upon them, the true spawn of hell like Peppino. Because she could have cried out for help, five servants in the house after all. And that would be the logical, practical question any man would ask. Why didn't you scream? And how could she answer logic when there was no logic in Peppino's crazy, hate-filled world? She was ashamed. That was part of the answer. And because Peppino was so fast and so brutal, she had thought, well, in a few minutes it will all be over. Knowing that if she did call out for help, it would never be over. Peppino would stand trial and be hanged, but half the town would think she had led him on. They would say, men always say, it wouldn't have happened if she had not really wanted it. As if anyone would want to look the devil in the face with all the servility and hypocrisy removed, with eyes that showed only hatred and rage and contempt for life. But she could never explain any of that to Guido. It was easier to call it rape, in the ordinary sense, because the act itself, despite what the priests say, is no big thing to a married woman. Sometimes, with Guido, it could be tender and quite wonderful, and sometimes it was just what a woman must do to keep her man happy, and she did not resent that. Guido did many things to keep her happy, but it is not like opera, it is no cataclysm. With a demon like Peppino, all you can think of is, don't make a fuss. Let it be over quickly, because if she screamed or resisted, he might really lose his head and he was capable of any atrocity. She was sure of her intuition now. Get it over and try. Try to forget it. That is what she thought with such a huge creature as Peppino pinning her beneath him. How could she tell Guido? How could she go into court and tell the judges? There were no stars spinning in the skies, no glory and magic, such as foolish men write in novels about adultery. It was not even painful, as I'm told real rape is. It was merely foul and hideous, like having your face pushed into something nasty on the street. The terror, the degradation, was all in the intangible, the opening of her body to a man she did not love but hated, and the fear, the sickening fear, that he would go wild completely and kill her afterwards, so that she could not denounce him and have him arrested. But Peppino Bassalmo did not kill her or even threaten her. He was sure she would not tell anyone. He, who was such a clever liar, was even more superlative at deceiving himself. He was convinced that she had capitulated because she could not control her passion for him, the pig. He stood there afterward, buttoning up, and bragged about his power over women and told her what a silly person she was. He said she had believed every brazen lie he ever spoke. His wife and three children were a myth, he said, laughing in her face. He spent his money on weapons to make a revolution, to kill all the rich. He did have children, he said. Many of them, probably, all over Italy. But he did not know the names of most of them, nor care. He had never been married. He said she had wronged him last year by acting surprised when she found out he could read. He said peasants had brains as good as anyone's, and all could read given a chance. It was a lie of the rich that peasants were too ignorant to learn. For that lie and that insult, he had decided to punish her. The punishment, he said, was to show her her own weakness and to prove he could give her greater pleasure than her fancy rich husband. He was sure of it. He stood there after it was all over, and it had taken only a few minutes, and he bragged about how he had taught her real passion. He said that the rich were all effeminate and that only a peasant who worked hard all day had the vigor to please a woman truly. He believed it. the colossal deceiver and self-deceiver that he was. He would not see that she had no feelings but loathing and humiliation, because she had cried out once in terror, and because her body had shaken with his crudity and violence, he believed she had been in spasms of pleasure. He made quite a long speech about it. He liked making speeches. He said all women were whores and many things like that, and he named all the other rich women in Napoli he had conquered by one dirty trick or another. It was strange, but as he talked about women, this libertine, he sounded very much like the Dominicans. And then he was gone. Peppino Bassomo, Joe, everybody, just another face in the crowd, anybody surf on any latifondi in Italy, or a demon from hell. She was never sure which was the true way to think of such a being. And Guido did not for a moment consider putting her aside. He wept, not that he was humiliated, but that she had been used brutally. And when the boy, Sigismundo, was born, Guido tried, he honestly tried, to be as good a father to him as to his own children. But as the years passed, as Sigismundo grew, Liliana had her own private hell, knowing the storm would come back yet again in a new form. When Sigismundo's temper flared and he stormed about the house like a wild animal, she told herself, "All boys do that sometimes. It is not demon blood. I must not think that way. He is usually a good child." But in his music she heard more and more of Peppino, the same force, the same uncompromising passion to go beyond all limits, to surpass human boundaries. "It is art," she told herself. "It is the same force, but it is turned towards creativity this time, not towards destruction. He is only trying to go beyond melody, not beyond morals and pity and all reason. He is not trying to impose his will upon the whole world, just upon the structure of music. I must not be afraid of my own son." Part 3. The Magician. Therefore, as logical metaphysics teaches that man contains all things by understanding them, homo intelligendo fit omnia, this poetic metaphysics reveals that man contains all things by not understanding them, homo non intelligendo fit omnia. Giambattista Vico, Scienza Nuova. For Sigismundo, it was back down the hill, round and round the curving roads, past one mule after another. For the first time, he wondered if there were more mules or fools in Napoli. But in either case, he was a prime candidate for king of either species. And then into the ghetto again. Some of the shops had not been repaired yet after the looting in August. But Sigismundo saw a group of people working to refurbish the walls of several buildings. The drunks who came down here and burned and looted and beat up old men thought they had a good reason to hate the Jews, he reflected. My perfect devil of a father thinks he has most excellent reasons to hate the nobles. The Dominicans have intricate and theologically orthodox reasons to hate anybody who reads the wrong books. The Jacobites hate the King of England, and he hates them back. Everybody has somebody to hate. It just proves that God's creation is above all perfectly balanced and orderly. My father is a cuckold, he thought, wonderful comic figure in every farce. No, I mean the man who pretends to be my father is a cuckold. My father isn't my father. My real father is some kind of arch-fiend and thinks I'm a likely apprentice demon. As Antonio said, we have been sentenced to hell because Napoli isn't yet quite bad enough for us. Perhaps, all things considered, I am a demoniac. That would explain why I thought I sensed God in my ancestors' heathen, unchristian temple, and why I now have the delusion that the holy Dominican fathers are mad dogs who have turned the Pope into a giant purple rooster, and that my mother is a whore. Uncle Pietro told me once that hysteria is a chaotic and irrational emotional state caused by seeing how the world really operates. But now they were in Dr. Orfali's shop, and the old Jew was whispering with Pietro. Talking about me, Sigismundo thought. Now you will work on my head, he said ironically. Everybody takes turns working on my head. There are liars in this town, sir, do you know that? They tell me my father is the devil and wishes me to succeed him as emperor of hell, that is to say, of this world. I will not work on your head, Dr. Orfali said gently. That is not necessary. You have the power. You can work on your own head. You are one of us. That is what they all say, Sigismundo remarked cynically. The devils say I am one of them. Is this some standard line all you magicians use? Old Abraham smiled. You are one of those with the power, he corrected himself. Which side you join is your own free choice. Now, just as an experiment, can you repeat one sentence? Try it. Ato Malkuth Vegabura Vegadula Le Olam. No, Sigismundo said. Tell me what it means first. You see, Abraham said to Pietro, he is actually quite rational, even prudent. Very well, he said to Sigismundo. It means, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever. I say it before each healing, because it is not I, Abraham Orfali, who heals people. It is God working through me. Now you are to become a healer, starting on yourself. So ask God to work through you. Say, Ato Malkuth Vegabura Vegadula Le Olam. There is a huge purple cock in the Vatican, Sigismundo said. There was a dog-faced thing in the corner, but each time he stared at it, it went away. No, Abraham cried, suddenly much taller. Stop that, in the name of the angel Emmanuel, whose name means the presence of God is with us. In the name of Emmanuel, who appeared beside Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the furnace of ineffable fire and was their protector. In the name of Emmanuel, who is here and everywhere, who is yesterday, today, and the brother of tomorrow. Sigismundo gulped, staring at the old man who spoke suddenly like thunder itself. I know all about chickens in the Vatican, and demonic dogs, and little green men with egg in their beard, Abraham said bitterly. They do not belong in this space, but in another crazy space. In the name of Emmanuel, I summon your spirit, Sigismundo Cellini, back to this space. Be perfectly aware and impartial, right where you are sitting now. Sigismundo came back into Euclidean space, back into the small rear room of Dr. Orfali's shop. Now repeat the invocation, Abraham said. Ato Malkuth Vegabura Vegadula Le Olam. Sigismundo repeated the invocation. Good. Excellent. Thank you, the doctor said. Now, just visualize the four archangels. Do you remember their names? Raphael, Gabriel, Michael, Ariel, Sigismundo said, immediately seeing them quite vividly. Now, with no drugs and nobody working on your head, all by yourself, pull the angels into you. Bring them in, from the four compass points, to the very center of your forehead. Sigismundo tried. After all, he thought, I am doing it myself. He is not forcing my mind, like those demoniacs last night. The angels coalesced in the center of his head. There was a tingling and a sense of light. Quite suddenly, there were no more amorphous figures lurking in the corner of his vision, and for the first time since the drug had been forced on him, he was not dizzy or lightheaded at all. Now listen, Abraham said, sitting down himself and talking in his ordinary voice. Why do you suppose they gave you that belladonna last night? If they want you to be their next leader, they should not be trying to drive you out of your mind. I don't understand that, Sigismundo admitted. That drug, pernicious as it is, will not drive you out of your mind. Abraham said, at least not with one dose. You are in no sense suffering the same civil war inside that your poor cousin suffered last year. What the Rossi have done is to push you to the edge of an abyss.
Yes, Sigismundo said, it is like standing on a cliff, and also as if I could see to infinity. But in between are these crazy places.
They have opened you to the fourth soul, Abraham said, in a brutal and sudden way. This is most dangerous. We in the FRC, lowering his voice, believe it must be done most gradually and carefully. They are not so scrupulous. They believe that if you cannot bear the shock, you do not deserve to be one of them. Now tell me about the things you have been seeing since the drug was administered.
Sigismundo frowned. They keep slipping away, he said. My memory doesn't seem to work properly yet.
That is typical of Belladonna, Abraham said. Tell me what you do remember.
Sigismundo recalled Carlo Maldonado pointing a pistol at him. Then suddenly that faded, and he had a rush of images of dog-faced things, green dancing tree men, winged lions, black men in turbans, a veiled goddess on a golden throne.
Typical of Yesod, Abraham said thoughtfully.
What does that mean?
They are old acquaintances, Abraham said whimsically. They are hallucinations only if you cannot control them. If a man can summon them at will and master them, they are keys to the deep levels of the psyche. But do not attempt that at your age. You want to be rid of them. Only when you are much older should you consider trafficking with them, as we in the FRC sometimes have to do.
You will find, Abraham went on, that they will fade away over about 2 weeks' time. When they are annoying, summon the angels to banish them. Keep a diary every day and write down every odd new idea that comes to your head. We will go over that diary together every few days, and I will help you through this period. The Rossi will not have you, I assure you. They do not understand the power, really. They are like drunken men playing with weapons, and eventually they will blow their own heads off.
They said it was destined that I come to them, Sigismundo replied uneasily. But they also said I would do it of my own free will.
Very well, the doctor said. I now tell you that it is divinely ordained that you will join us in the Rose Cross Order. There appear to be two rival prophecies at this time. Who will decide which prophecy will come true?
I will, Sigismundo said hesitantly.
You what?
I will.
You see, Abraham said, nobody has to work on your head. You understand the basics already. Now, I'm sure a lad of your curiosity has heard something of the goals of our order. What are they reputed to be?
The medicine of metals, which changes all substances at the pleasure of the magician, and the stone of the wise, which some say is a code name for the Holy Grail, and the elixir of life, which gives longevity, and true wisdom, and perfect happiness. Now, suppose I tell you that all those are just different metaphors and symbols for the same thing, Abraham smiled. I wager you will be able to tell me at once what that thing is.
The fourth soul, Sigismundo said, quite certain.
And another name for it?
My will, Sigismundo said.
No, Abraham said. The fourth soul is your will united with the will of God.
That was the real beginning, not the end of anything. Sigismundo returned to Dr. Orfali's shop many times. They discussed many things. Abraham talked of Yesod, which is a level of consciousness existing in all men but usually operating without the awareness of the ego. All the supernatural figures Sigismundo had seen since being given the Belladonna were denizens of Yesod. They are part of you, not outside at all, but they are not your creation since they are part of all men and women, Abraham said. Notice how many coincidences are connected with their appearances? That will show you that there are a link between all individual minds. Sigismundo did not understand at all, but he did begin noticing coincidences. They spoke of the next step, which is the goal of the FRC,
the formation of the fourth soul in all humans, whereby humanity will be completely transformed, as in a refiner's fire, the scriptures say. Often they talked of Peppino Balsamo. "I hate him," Sigismundo said bitterly. Abraham waited and watched. "Now tell me the truth," he said finally. "He is my father. I wish I didn't have to hate him." "You are wishing you could love him." "Yes, I wish he was not what he is." "It is natural. All boys want to love and admire their fathers. Between father and son, even hate is just frustrated love." "Then he will have me eventually. He is a murderer and a devil worshipper and God knows what else, but there is a destiny in it. Every day now I remember. I'm not really of the nobility. I am a half-Sicilian, half-peasant. What evil joke is it that I wear silks and eat what I want, while my brothers and sisters and cousins on the farms are in rags and starving? He has put a spell on me. This red revolution, cruel as it is, will lure me in the end." Abraham was silent again, waiting. "Now say the rest of it," he prompted. "I hate the violence," Sigismundo cried. "I think the Rossi are madmen. Certainly there is injustice in the world, but it will never be changed by lunatics like them. If I knew where they are, I would turn them into the Inquisition to be burned like the garbage they are. I would like to see them burn, all of them, including my father." "So, who is the real Sigismundo speaking?" Abraham asked. "The one who will join the Rossi, or the one who will turn them into the Inquisition?" "Riposte, parry, all life is fencing," Sigismundo thought. "I wish I knew," he said wearily. "You will know when the time comes." But that night, Sigismundo dreamed that Dogface Rossi were in his room. He knew it was a dream, and he forced himself to wake, but they were still there. Battling terror, he reasoned, "I did not wake, I just dreamed that I wakened." With another effort, he struggled toward consciousness again. They were still there. The Yesod, the other world, between nightmare and reality, the crazy space. He prayed, toward the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty. The images of nightmare faded. Sigismundo was fully awake now. It was only the drug, he told himself. They cannot linger after the dream ends, except for that cursed drug, and each week there is less of the drug left in my bloodstream. This is most educational if I do not let it scare the living Jesus out of me. I can see a part of my mind that most people never see. Then another dark figure moved suddenly between him and the window. When you keep trying to wake and the nightmare still goes on, that is the true horror. "Sigismundo?" It was Mama's voice. She moved closer and he could recognize her face even in the dark. "Were you having a bad dream? I thought I heard you cry out." He had been brave when the Rossi surrounded him with drawn daggers, and he had defied them. He had been brave for over a month since, whenever the dog-faced or faceless things appeared, staring at them and willing them to go away. He was suddenly, in the middle of the night and in the dark, too tired to be brave anymore. "Mama," he said, "I'm frightened." She came and held him, and he thought, what Peppino did to her was worse than what he did to me. As if she guessed his thoughts, Mama said, "He will not last much longer." She would not speak Peppino's name. "Pietro is spending all kinds of money through every contact he has. He will be caught and punished." And then, Sigismundo thought grimly, the others will be ready to receive me as his successor. The next week, Frankenstein came to Napoli. The rumor ran through town like Mercury himself. The most famous alchemist in all Europe was in the marketplace. He had set up a tent and was performing miracles that astounded all witnesses. "Of course, if you wanted to see him," the rumors added, "you'd better hurry. As soon as the Dominicans get wind of this, he is sure to be arrested. Sigismundo could not resist a show as promising as this. After all, everybody in Europe knew about Johann de Pell von Frankenstein, who had allegedly performed more wonders than all the sorcerers in Bavaria combined. Many had actually seen him turn lead into gold, or thought they saw that, as Uncle Pietro would say. He was widely believed to be between 90 and 120 years old, although he always looked young, and he once had a spot of bother with the Inquisition in Tuscany when he told a crowd that, like Elijah, he would never die. Most marvelous and incredible of all was the legend that de Pell of Frankenstein had once achieved the greatest of all alchemical feats. He had built a homunculus, an imitation human being, perfect in every detail except, of course, it didn't have a soul. So many in Bavaria had allegedly seen this machine, or this creature, or whatever it was, that the authorities were moved to condemn von Frankenstein for black magic. He couldn't go back to Bavaria, it was said, and he didn't dare show the thing, whatever it was, anywhere else. But many claimed he still had it hidden somewhere, and it was getting bigger and stronger all the time. Of course, Sigismundo had seen some of the clever automatons that other mountebanks exhibited in the market from time to time, figurines that would dance to music or come out of their tiny houses and bow to the audience and sing, or heads that would move their eyes and answer questions. But whatever the mechanical technique of each such wonder, they all look like painted creations of plaster and metal. Frankenstein's imitation man, the legends say, looked and acted like a real man. He even smoked a pipe. There were more sinister tales, too, saying that it, the thing, whatever it was, had a foul temper, and you wouldn't want to meet it on a dark street. At twilight, the tent was opened for business. De Pell of Frankenstein was a tall man, not blonde like most Bavarians, but dark, with a great hawkish nose like Julius Caesar and crafty, calculating eyes. He did not look a day older than 30, despite the fact that he was known to have been born in 1673. Frankenstein removed his hat and bowed, waving the hat in a wide arc. Abruptly, he drew the hat back and held it before his chest. With his left hand, he produced a live rabbit out of it. A few small children cheered. Most of the adults muttered. They had seen that trick 1,000 times. Frankenstein held the rabbit above his head and suddenly slapped his palms together. The rabbit was gone. "Things come out of the void for no reason," Frankenstein intoned in a rich, solemn voice, "and they return to the void for no reason." Sigismundo sat up, curious. Mountebanks were apt to say all sorts of vaguely mystical-sounding things, but was this not daringly like the Epicurean heresy? Frankenstein leaned forward, almost kneeling, and clapped his hands again. The rabbit was suddenly hopping about in front of him on the floor. "And things can be made to come back out of the void," Frankenstein said hermetically, "by those who know the secrets of the will." Of course, Sigismundo thought, it is probably not a rabbit at all, something that folds up and expands again, made of paper with springs inside, perhaps. Frankenstein raised the rabbit, or whatever it was, by the ears and carried it back to a table full of strange apparatus. He held it aloft and suddenly produced a razor to slit its throat. There was a gasp, and the blood gushed into a basin. "Orange dye inside the mechanism," Sigismundo guessed. "We are not subject to the angels or to death entirely, save by failure of the will," Frankenstein intoned. He threw the dead rabbit into a bin and poured the blood, if it was blood, into a large, clear glass beaker. Then he stepped back and produced a pistol. He fired at the beaker. Amid shattering glass and red blood, or dye, the rabbit leaped out and hopped across the stage. There were several more tricks of that sort, and even the adults were excited by now. Each trick had a new twist that they hadn't seen before. Sigismundo noticed that the patter kept returning monotonously to the themes of the void and the will. "I have a message for P," Frankenstein said suddenly. "Is there a P here?" It would be a real miracle, Sigismundo thought, if there were no Paolo or Pietro in a crowd this size.
Is it for me? A shopkeeper asked. I'm Paolo Marconani.
Somebody has been stealing from you, Frankenstein said solemnly.
Yes, yes, Marconani said, and I think I know who the fatherless one is.
He suspects his clerk, Sigismundo guessed. What clerk doesn't feel underpaid and borrow a little now and then? He is a man you have trusted, a man you have done great kindness for, Frankenstein said. The clerk would see it somewhat differently, Sigismundo reflected.
You will do the right thing, Frankenstein said ambiguously.
You will think it over tonight, and you will know the proper course.
The clerk will find a new job in Roma, Sigismundo thought.
S.B., Frankenstein said suddenly. I am getting the letters S.B. Nobody responded.
Wait, Frankenstein said. I see more clearly. You do not use that name. You would rather forget it.
Sigismundo Balsamo. Oh, no, it's just a coincidence, a lucky guess. Don't get suckered in like that, shopkeeper.
You are right to resist your father, Frankenstein said. He is an evil man. But your future is not with the white-haired old man who calls up angels either.
Sigismundo controlled his face. I will not give him any clues. I will not be played for a fool again.
You must find your own path, Frankenstein said, but you cannot abandon the power, not ever. If you ever try, it will almost kill you.
He was looking directly at Sigismundo, but then his glance moved on. To protect me? Or is every imaginative adolescent getting a few seconds of that meaningful gaze?
You will hear from me again, Frankenstein said. I will help you find the true path.
Holy Mother of God, Sigismundo thought. He's trying to recruit me, too. Everybody wants me to learn their secret hand grips and join their own special conspiracy.
Remember this prophecy, Frankenstein said in his organ solemn tones, again addressing the whole audience. The son of the hawk shall appear in the east. He shall be marked with the sign of the beast. His mother a whore, his father a thief. The earth will shake in violence and grief. These words are a riddle, their meaning unclear. Understand only, ye have nothing to fear.
When was Frankenstein born? Sigismundo asked Father Ratti the next day.
In 1673, the priest said calmly. That was what Sigismundo had always heard. But the man he had seen simply did not look to be 92 years old.
And he died in 1734, Ratti added, at the age of 61.
I don't understand.
I have seen two Frankensteins in my time, Father Ratti said, and often it seems that he is performing miracles in two different cities at the same time. That is even more remarkable than climbing out of his grave and going on tour, is it not?
Oh, Sigismundo said. You mean any traveling mountebank can call himself Frankenstein?
Exactly. I even saw Faustus once in a fair at Hamburg, and he died in 1580, or at least his friends took the liberty of burying him then. Sigismundo returned to the market that night to see what further mystifications the alleged Frankenstein would offer. But the tent was gone. The mountebank had left as abruptly as he had come.
We are most fortunate, Father Ratti said one Monday. The good Dominicans, the ornament and glory of Mother Church and the model towards which all other, and hence lesser, orders can only aspire, will be holding a retreat for all the boys in the local colleges. The retreat will begin on Wednesday afternoon. Friday afternoon confessions will be heard for all of those who have found blemish in themselves. I can only pray, Ratti said without a smile, that this solemn occasion will bring us closer to that holy sanctity and Christ-like spirit that the Dominicans exemplify. On Wednesday afternoon, Sigismundo and the rest of his class and dozens of boys from other colleges in Napoli
filed into the Dominican chapel. The Dominican preacher was a monk with a shaved head and eyes that had not liked anything they had looked on in this world. Sigismundo wondered if this man worked in the interrogation branch of the Inquisition when not holding retreats for young boys. He looked like he'd known how to apply the thumbscrew, counting 5 beads on his rosary for 5 turns of the screw, and praising God all the while. "I'm sure this is not the first retreat you boys have attended," the Dominican said, "and, if God protects you and you remain good Catholics, it will not be the last. Some of you may even regard it as a rather boring ordeal you are forced to undergo once a year. It would be more fun to be playing ball in the park or going to fencing class, I'm sure." "I can understand that. I was a boy myself once." "And he probably pulled the wings off flies," Sigismundo thought. "Still," the Dominican said, "Holy Mother Church has a reason for demanding periodic retreats. The world is a vile place these days. It is full of sin and temptations to sin. It is also full of worry and anxiety and problems of all sorts. Living in this world is not conducive to contemplation of God, and it is almost impossible to achieve union with the will of God while we are in the world. That is why some orders are cloistered and do not come out of the world ever, for all their lives. And that is why retreats from the world like this one are necessary. We must depart from this wicked and fallen world occasionally if we are to see through its evils and delusions and come closer to the light that is God, the light that was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. To retreat from the world, we must begin by considering the final things, the things that the world ignores in its bustle for money and pleasure and success. You all know the final things. They have been mentioned many times in religious knowledge class. Every one of you can name them: death, judgment, hell, and heaven. But the purpose of a retreat is not merely to name them, my dear children. The purpose of a retreat is to think deeply about them, to come to know them, so that when we return to the world, we shall not be deceived by the world, so that we will know that the proud man is proud only for a while. The lust-filled fornicating man is groveling in his swinish pleasure only for a while. The rich man is rich only for a while. At the end, they all must face, you and I must face, the last things: death, judgment, hell, and heaven. Death, you all know, may come at any time. The typhus might come back to Napoli. A flower pot could fall off a roof and crush your skull. And, after death, each of us, man, woman, and child, must face the judgment. And after the judgment, it is either heaven or hell forever. That is the purpose of a retreat, to face this fact of existence, to stop for a while avoiding it, and to look at it honestly. We must die. We must be judged. And then, dear boys, will it be hell or heaven? Satan is subtle and tireless and has many traps. And this is especially true for those of you who are almost becoming adults. It is easy to lead you to the ways of impurity, to sinful thoughts and carnal desires, even before you are aware that you are allowing the devil to enter you. There are many artists who claim to be good Christians, and yet their paintings seem calculated only to arouse lustful and impure thoughts. Do you turn your eyes away from such paintings quickly, or do you allow Satan to enter you for a few minutes? Do you allow sinful fantasies to form? Have you allowed lewd companions with jokes and sophistries to convince you that such things are not really serious? Oh, my little brothers in Christ, the Word of God assures us that such sins are serious, and they quickly lead to worse sins. I tremble to think of it, but many boys are led from these impure paintings to acts of self-pollution, to the mortal sin of Onan, to the destruction of the seed that was given us only to populate the earth. Sin always enters the soul with a lie, a perversion of reason, a plausible deception. It is said that Lucifer's sin was pride, but in a sense, all sins are sins of pride. In every case,
we set our fallible, personal judgment against the revealed Word of God. The greatest poet the world has ever known, the great Dante, said it: "The path to hell is easy." We enter without admitting to ourselves that we have chosen that path, like Paolo and Francesca, the very first sinners we meet in Dante's hell. They read a book they should not have read. What harm is this, they probably thought. The church is too strict. We can read and judge for ourselves. And so they went their way to eternal damnation. Oh, my little children, it is a hard thing for mortal man to understand eternal damnation. At your age, you probably do not think further ahead than the next holiday. The farmer plans for the harvest. The man of business may plan for 5 or 10 years ahead, but nobody can plan for eternity. It is too large for our small minds. This is only one day in all the history of the world, and yet this day has been full already. You can remember waking and washing and eating breakfast and walking to this chapel. You may remember those you spoke to before coming in. Every hour is full of incidents and events, and yet eternity is not made of 1,000 hours, nor 1,000,000, nor 1,000,000,000. It contains an infinite number of hours, an infinite number of days, an infinite number of years. This is impossible for mortal man to understand, but we can form some image of it. Imagine waking, not in your bed at home, but on a bed of coals. Imagine that the fire burns forever but consumes not. You have all been burned at some time, I'm sure, but that is only natural fire. The pain of hell is the pain of supernatural fire. It is infinite pain, endless torment. It burns forever, but it never consumes the victim. It is supernaturally renewed so that the pain never ends. And I suppose some of you remember being afraid of the dark when you were smaller. Even adults sometimes do not like to go into dark and strange places alone, and yet hell is always dark. The supernatural fires burn forever, but just as they never devour the victim totally, they never shed even a glimmer of light. It is a place of inky darkness, inhabited only by fellow sinners and by fearsome demons who afflict the sinners with torture and mockery. Monstrous demons who cannot be seen, but whose leathery wings and scaly skin and buzzing speech are loathsome, and whose only ambition is to torment the sinners forever. This is the punishment for those who depart from God's law, Lutherans and other heretics and fornicators, and those who think impure paintings and lewd books are no serious matter. Many of you go to Jesuit colleges. It is an admirable thing about the Society of Jesus that they build so many colleges and staff them with so many scholars of great erudition, even if their theology is not always perfectly accurate. They are fine scientists, the Jesuits. Their mathematicians are among the best in Europe. Those of you who have studied with them know what infinity means. You know that if you write 1, and then 10, and then 100, and then 1,000, and keep on writing like that for the rest of your life, no matter how many zeros you add, you will still be no closer to infinity. And this is the final agony of hell, the knowledge, sure and certain and unchanging, that every pain, every terror, every hour of agony will be repeated and repeated and repeated forever and ever and ever without end. That is eternity. There was a muffled sob. Sigismundo looked around covertly. The sob came from a child who looked about 11. He's fair ready to urinate needles, Sigismundo thought. Some ask how a just God can inflict such tortures on his creatures, the Dominican went on. But it is precisely because God is just that hell is necessary. God is infinitely good, as you all know, because if he were not infinitely good, and by definition, he would not be God. Therefore, any departure from God's laws, the laws of infinite goodness, must be infinitely evil. An infinite evil demands in logic, in justice, an infinite punishment. San Tommaso di Aquino, the greatest of the teachers of the Dominican order,
was so wise that some have named him the Angelic Doctor, even though he wasn't a high-toned Jesuit. And San Tommaso wrote that for hell to be infinite, it must be metaphysical. That is, the pains I have described are only the lesser of its evils. The supreme evil, the final horror of hell, is a metaphysical pain. The poena damni, the pain of damnation. Let me explain that. God is with us every minute, every second. We do not feel his presence, usually, because we are too concerned with our own little minds. Yet he is always there. When you laugh, he laughs with you and through you. When you play, he plays among you. When you look at the starry skies and feel awe and wonderment, he is within you and within the stars themselves. All things that are reflections of the divine light of Godhood. We are never deprived of that light. Except in sin, in lustful thoughts, in impure jokes, in foul sensuality, in the company of whores, in unnatural vices, in lies and heresies and other offenses, we separate ourselves from God. The light goes out of our lives. Things become problems, worries, anxieties. That is the beginning of the absence of God. That is the state of mortal sin. Hell, you see, is the total absence of God. The darkness there is both physical and metaphysical. There is no light there because there is no mind that reflects God, no mind that reflects anything but its own vices, no mind not perverted by hatred and guilt and self-pity. There is no hope because eternity never ends. There is simply despair. Forever. Forever and forever and forever. Eternal darkness and eternal despair. That is hell. We will think more deeply on these things tomorrow. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. That night, Sigismundo dreamed that he was being initiated into the Rossi by his blonde murderous father, Peppino Besomo. Everybody was wearing crocodile masks instead of hoods, and when they invoked their four fallen angels, all four appeared quite solidly. Orpheus said that Sigismundo was his to claim, because those who love music more than God are sons of Orpheus. But Aradia claimed him also because he wanted to see Maria Maldonado naked and put his dirty thing inside her. And Lucifer said Sigismundo was his son, because no man ever lived with such diabolic pride. But Mother Tana took him as her own because he was secretly her ally and the ally of all her children who were poor and angry and knew the sacrament of the dagger. Was the dream sent by God to warn him of his dangerous tendencies? For that matter, was the retreat especially for him, because he was so far gone in heresy? When Sigismundo entered the chapel Thursday morning, he did not feel at all superior to the boy who had let out that involuntary sob the day before. "I will be defecating purple boulders before this is over," he thought. "Today," the Dominican said, "we are going to consider the sins that are most hateful to God and most likely to entice boys your age. I refer to the sins of impurity." What is impurity? It is a blemish, as when we say the color is not pure in a piece of cloth, because a stain has gotten into the dye. It is a poison, as when we say the water is not pure, meaning that it will kill you to drink it. It is a discord, as when we say the music is not pure because perhaps the violin has hit a wrong note. Stain, poison, discord. These, then, are the synonyms for impurity. In each case, there is an ugliness, a foulness, a danger. We wince at impure music. We reject an impure color. We fear impure food. God, in his mercy, has made the sins of the flesh equally foul so that we will instinctively avoid them. Ah, but Satan is always busy
busy, busy, always plotting, always fertile in new tricks and deceptions. He knows well how to offer us that perversion of reason, that plausible lie that will lure us into our damnation. He knows how to disguise the foulness of womankind so that even the holiest, the most pious, the best among us can at times be drawn toward the cesspool of vice, seeing it in delusion as the fountain of blessedness.
Sigismundo was sweating profusely. The air in the chapel was dead. All the doors were closed. This is what it means to be stifled, he thought. The priest went on, but Sigismundo tried to think of music so he would not grow faint and disgrace himself. The words still hammered at him. Neither Vivaldi nor Telemann could drown them out. Satan has invented paints and rouges for women, the better to lure us. But what do they lure us to? You have all seen the copulations of dogs, of donkeys, of pigs. Is not that an ugly and grotesque sight? Yet Satan would put a myth over our eyes and lead us to believe our fornications are not equally bestial and obscene. Why did God make woman inferior to man? He wishes us to avoid these occasions of sin, as the great San Tommaso called them, these sacks of dung, in Origen's words. I will not faint, Sigismundo thought, even if the air is unbreathable. I will hold my dignity. Do you know what the French pox does? The boils? The pain in urination? I haven't done it. I've only thought about it. Some go blind and must beg on the streets in eternal darkness, living in the black pit of hell in this world, even before being condemned to it after the judgment. And there is no cure for this hideous disease. It went on and on and on. And remember, I implore you, the last things, death, the judgment, heaven, and hell. Remember the black and bottomless pit where no sane voice is ever heard, where the flame burns and scalds and torments but consumes not. Hell is forever. That is what we must think upon in this retreat from the world. Hell is forever. May we avoid it, I pray. May we find our way to God and to the peace that passeth understanding. May we be aware of the painted woman, who is all perfume on the outside, and a foul, rotten, stinking cauldron of blood and urine and pox within. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. At a signal, the boys all knelt to examine their consciences. The Dominican, sweating like a runaway horse, left the podium. The boys were alone with their thoughts. Another monk in the back watched them so that they would remain kneeling and contemplating their sins for the required amount of time. After 45 minutes, the boys were allowed to leave the chapel and file into the dining hall, where bread and water were served to remind them that they were here to leave the world and its superficial pleasures behind and contemplate the eternal things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell. That afternoon, the Dominican spoke of heresy. All Europe is an armed camp, he said. We live in a permanent state of war and preparations for war. This terrible condition is no accident. It is the way Satan wishes it to be. It is the proof of his success in misleading and deceiving men. There is no heresy that is not boldly proclaimed among the so-called intellectual classes in Protestant countries, such as England. Even in France, the Inquisition is hamstrung by meddlesome aristocrats, and the most vile satirical books are freely published. And yes, even here in Italy, less in Napoli than in the north, of course, many books circulate that our ancestors, in their wisdom, would have thrown into the public bonfire at once. And even here in Napoli, the heresy of liberalism has, at times, appeared. Most of you are not old enough to remember Don Carlos, the uncle of King Ferdinand. You all know that Carlos built that wonderful opera house, the largest and most beautiful in the world, but Carlos also did a terrible thing. Misled by French fads
He passed an edict of toleration for the Jews. He gave them permission to practice their religion here in Napoli, a religion without Christ in the center of Catholicism. Heresy, you see, had reached even into the court at that time. Your fathers will tell you what happened. God turned his face away from Don Carlos. That unfortunate king waited year after year, but his queen produced no male heir to the throne. Finally, beginning to listen to the wise words of the Grand Inquisitor at last, King Carlos withdrew that absurd, that blasphemous edict of toleration. The Jews may live among us, he said, but they may not practice their black and blasphemous religion, which denies Christ. How has Satan accomplished so much in only a few centuries, so that even a king in this most Catholic part of Italy would fall into such error? How has the Prince of Darkness led men into the war of all against all that is modern Europe? It has been done through conspiracies and secret societies. That is why the Inquisition can never rest. A little spark may ignite 1,000 acres, as any farmer will tell you. I remind you again that Satan is always busy, busy, busy. I am sure many of you have heard the tales of the old Carbonari, who would appear out of nowhere in the night like the 3 wise men who come at Christmas. A poor family would hear a knock at the door. They would open, and the Carbonari, with lamp black on their faces, would hand them food and clothing and money. And then they would disappear again, saying only, "We do it for the widow's son." What harm is that, you might ask? Many have asked, and many have seen no harm in it. Some men of business, they thought, who like to dress up in strange costumes and do charitable works anonymously. That was what it was meant to look like, but it was actually the work of Satan. In this way, men's minds were influenced to think that secret societies might be benevolent. They forgot that every group that acts clandestinely might be a portal to the powers of the darkness and old night. And then, behind the scenes, the real malefactors would pull the strings, the illuminated ones of Spain, who are actually Mohammedans pretending to be Christians. Now, all over Europe, there are these groups, usually calling themselves Freemasons, doing these charitable works for the widow's son, as they say. And the foolish ask, "What harm is that?" And more each year are lured into Masonry and its allies and affiliates. What harm is that? Oh, dear little brothers in Christ, these Masonic lodges are the chief sources of the heresy of toleration. It makes no difference, they say, if a man is a Catholic or a Protestant. He can still be a Mason. It makes no difference if he is a Jew or a Muslim. He can be a Mason. It makes no difference if his loyalty is to an Italian prince, a Swiss parliament, or a caliph in Baghdad. He can still be a Mason. And so, with a perversion of reason, with a plausible lie of toleration, this secret society grows and grows, and the unity of the faith is corroded. If there is no one true religion, if all religions are equally true, then why bother with the sacraments? Why bother with confession and repentance? Why burn books with improper language or doctrinal error in them, since no man can be sure of the truth? And so it goes, until the church will be destroyed utterly, and Christ's message will be lost, and each man will be his own pope, and Christ and Bible, and there will be Satan's kingdom on earth. Universal anarchy. If you know a boy who collects books with improper language not suitable for young adults, you must report this. It is your duty. Such books are poison. It is the same with books of moral and doctrinal heresy and subtle satire on God-given institutions. They must not be allowed to corrupt innocent souls. They must not lead others into eternal damnation and the fire that burns forever and is not quenched. But what about a mother, a father, a beloved relative? It makes no difference. "I come to set brother against brother," our Lord said, and, "I come not to bring peace, but a sword." It must needs be so. The church militant on earth is our family, our true father and mother. The sheep who obey and are docile must be separated from the egotistic and self-willed goats who rebel against all authority. Satan's work must be stamped out. Remember the last things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell. Will you go with a gentle sheep directed by those wiser than themselves? Or will you join the goats who say, I know better than anyone, and plunge, like Satan, the father of pride, to doom and perdition? Let me add this. In the 38 years that I have served the Holy Office, I have sat on tribunals that judged over 900 heretics. That includes mass trials of whole families and whole lodges of secret societies, of course. And do you know how many of those accused were actually turned over to the civil authorities for public execution? Only 15. Only 15 were so stubborn and obdurate in their pride as to be considered beyond redemption. All the others, all, made submission and confessed their errors. And they were given very minor punishments. Some were sent to prison for life. Some, especially repentant, were allowed to enter monasteries or, in the case of women, nunneries, to spend the rest of their lives in prayer and mortification. And a great many were merely assigned a simple penance, such as making pilgrimage to a holy shrine, and there doing public mortification for a period of weeks or months. So, if you know of secret societies or passwords, or of heretical books or pamphlets, it is your duty to tell your confessor tomorrow. Think upon these things. Search your consciences. Pray all night long, I beg you. In the morning, confessions will be heard. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, Amen. Sigismundo searched his conscience all day and much of the night. The next day, as time for confession approached, he was still in turmoil. Dog-faced things were beginning to appear again near the edge of his vision. He knew the Dominican's final argument had been true. There were few burnings these days in Napoli. Most heretics just lost their property and went to prison. Huge mass burnings occurred only in Spain, and not so often there anymore either. He thought of Uncle Pietro in prison, Father Ratti sent off to a monastery to do perpetual penance, and Giancarlo Tenoni was in the club too. What would happen to old man Tenoni? In his fearless and taurine way, he would tell the inquisitors to go intercourse themselves if they asked him to name names. Sigismundo also thought of Abraham Orfali, an old Jew who practices magic and has no property worth confiscating, that could turn into a burning offense. The reason there were so few burnings these days, really, was that opponents of the Inquisition were gaining in power. The erudite Jesuits, the noble families who had had relatives condemned in the past, the merchants who resented the constant snooping that accompanied all inquisitorial activities. But you could not depend on such trends continuing. Politics was full of surprises. If the Dominicans were in favor with the Vatican again, if they wasted a demonstration of their continued power, everybody might burn. Uncle Pietro, Dr. Orfali, Tenoni, Father Ratti, all. And the whole church, not just the Dominicans, taught that to make an unworthy confession to conceal sins was itself a mortal sin. I have gone far, far into heresy. Into the selva scura, the mental spaghetti, Sigismundo thought. But have I gone far enough to doubt the whole church? Can I deliberately make a mockery of the sacrament of confession? Especially when that thing that has been following me around since yesterday, the one with the lion's face and bat's wings, might actually be a demon. They are old acquaintances. They are hallucinations only if you cannot control them. What was Pascal's wager? Sigismundo reconstructed the famous argument of the great mathematician. The value of a wager is equal to the value of the possible gain multiplied by the probability of achieving that gain. If you obey the church, like the gentle sheep, the possible gain is infinite bliss in heaven. Say the probability
of this is very low as any French skeptic claims. Say, 0.00000000001%. Still, the value of the wager is infinity times this probability, and infinity times anything, however small, is still infinity. And on the other side, if you join the proud and rebellious goats, the same mathematics yields the same result. The possible loss is infinite. So even the probability of hell is as low as 0.00000000000000000000000000001%. The total value emerges as infinity again. Infinite pain in this case. The probabilities simply disappear as insignificant when the gain is infinite bliss and the loss is infinite torment. That was Pascal's mathematics, and you couldn't refute it. The retreat of the past 3 days had made infinite pain a very real concept to Sigismundo. Could he risk that, setting his adolescent judgment against the wise teachers of the whole church? He who was so often a fool? If he confessed fully and honestly as the sacrament demanded in order to be valid, the people arrested would only suffer finite pain during interrogation. Even if they were burned, which was not really likely these days, that would still be finite pain. And besides, he thought, I won't feel it. That was a vile, selfish thought. But if I do not confess fully, I will face infinite pain. There is just no scale that can measure the finite against the infinite. And besides, I will not feel their pain. Sigismundo suddenly felt an enormous revulsion, not against himself alone for having these thoughts, but against the church for forcing him to make such choices. Infinity doesn't change it, he thought angrily. It's my pain versus the pain of those I love, those who have trusted me. That, and that alone, is what they are forcing me to decide. Pascal's wager might be mathematically sound, but did not Pascal himself say that the heart has its reasons, that the reason knows not? I cannot betray my friends, and that is all there is to it. To hell with mathematics, to hell with probability, to hell with logic, to hell with theology, to hell with all the philosophical spaghetti. I do not turn on my friends because I am afraid. I am not a donkey to be led by the carrot of salvation and the stick of damnation without thinking of where they are driving me and what they are making me do. So, I shall now enter into mortal sin knowingly, and that is the definition of mortal sin, that you do it knowingly. And then, if the church is right, the devil will have my soul. My father will win in the end. As Dante said, the path to hell is easy. First a lying confession, and then downward, 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 to every abomination, whores, and books with coarse language, and the Rosso madness. I am not meant to be a saint, he thought. I have too many passions, too much pride and fury and rebellion in me. And I am not an ordinary boy. I have the power sometimes. Perhaps I am destined to be the greatest of sinners, the king of the diabolists. It was his turn to enter the confessional. Sigismundo knelt, seeing the priest's shadow through the screen. Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. What do you have to confess, my son? Impure thoughts frequently. I do not always resist them. And so on, and so on. He had been through it once a month for 8 years, since his first Holy Communion at 6. Always the same sins, anger, pride, bad language twice. But never before this tension of the one great sin held back, not confessed. Anything else? The priest said finally. Tempus locendi, tempus tecendi. No. Sigismundo said, that is all, Father. You are experiencing the normal temptations of your age, the priest said kindly. You must pray, and I will pray for you. And then it was over. Sigismundo was outside the confessional kneeling in prayer at the altar rail,
His prayers were jumbled, his mind wandered. He was swinging wildly between anxiety and resignation.
It is done. I am cut off from the church, whatever Uncle Pietro and Father Ratti say.
1700 years of theology pronounces that I have damned myself. Jesuitical equivocations cannot change that. But then if working for peace and brotherhood, even if by means of masonry, is not a sin, there was no need to confess it. The Dominican lied, and I am not damned. I have no certitude left about anything.
Sigismundo remembered the day he heard the Frenchman mock the miracle of San Gennaro's blood. He had thought that day that some things were sure. Flaming rocks do not fall out of the sky, priests do not lie. But either Ratti or the Dominican had lied, and Mama had never been unfaithful to Papa.
Is there anything I'm still sure of?
Oh yes, he thought wryly, the last item on that list. I am Sigismundo Cellini of Napoli, not the man in the moon.
Well, I am Sigismundo Balsamo of Napoli, not the man in the moon.